In the morning, when you need the news that matters most.
Yeah, what we say now is going to be measured against the facts, the consequences of which will be far worse if we don't say anything and it goes the other way.
I disagree.
You need the front page.
Channel 7, right? You're the guy that went crazy.
I had a bad moment.
What are you doing here?
Just looking for a story.
There's no story here. This pond is all fished out.
With Graney and Bischoff.
In spite of there being no source for this information, to say nothing of the absurdity of the figure.
On the Press Box.
I don't know. My instinct tells me there's something more.
Vikings defensive coordinator Brian Flores is suing the NFL, alleging discrimination against black coaches in the NFL. And very similar to the John Gruden win this week against the NFL, Flores had the same type of win where his lawsuit is going to be heard in court, that it will not be put into arbitration as the NFL was looking to do. Again, very similar to the John Gruden case. It's not a necessary win in the actual lawsuit, more of a win of where that lawsuit will be heard and will be judged. So it will go to actual court. Flores is suing the NFL and three teams, the Broncos, the Giants, and the Texans, and saying that the NFL discriminates against black coaches. So we will presumably, I guess they could settle out of court and we never hear anything, but we will presumably get some sort of lawsuit played out in court between Brian Flores and the NFL.
Yeah, not a good week for Roger Goodell is my short analysis.
Yeah. The one thing that I do like about this is that Brian Flores actually does have a job in the NFL as a defensive coordinator, because if you remember when he brought this lawsuit, he even came out and said, I'm probably putting my career as an NFL head coach in jeopardy, might never get a job. And that very easily could have happened. He's not a head coach right now, but as a defensive coordinator for the Vikings, good to see that he still has one while bringing this lawsuit. Also kind of funny that a guy who's coaching in the NFL is currently suing the NFL.
That's a great question.
According to Pat Forty, indictments are coming for point shaving in college basketball. So this has been going on for a couple of years. There are a few different schools and players that have been involved. But federal investigators are interviewing players suspected of manipulating their performances for the benefit of gamblers who wagered on their games. From Pat Forty, the investigation covers multiple regions and teams, sources say, with a current focus on Southern schools. A source with knowledge of the investigation says, there are going to be charges. It's going to be national in scope. It's going to involve multiple players and programs. One note, the Jonte Porter NBA player who was taking himself out of games with a fake injury so that he would hit his under, so that people who bet on his unders would win. That ring of guys that were gambling on Jonte Porter unders are involved in this as well. The NCAA, by the way, themselves have been investigating New Orleans, Eastern Michigan, Mississippi Valley State, and Temple for different gambling-related problems. So it sounds like we might get in the near future sort of maybe a more clearer package, just have all of this in one place as to what actually has been going on and maybe how separate these were or if they were all together. But it sounds like we're going to get a little bit more clarity on what has been happening with these gambling investigations in college basketball.
I can add a little bit to this from reporting that we have coming where I work at iGaming Business, that the schools that are involved, while we can't name them yet, will be additional to that list that you just mentioned. It is not what I would consider to be among the biggest names in college athletics in terms of the name of the schools, but expect that more of that will come down probably in the next 2 to 4 weeks.
Okay, so that part is interesting because right now, New Orleans, Eastern Michigan, Mississippi Valley State, and Temple. If there are more schools, and if Temple is still the biggest name, do sports fans care? Like, do are fans going to be like, oh, Eastern Michigan point shaving? Because I get the sense it'll be more of a, huh, what are those guys doing? And then you just sort of move on and say, okay, whatever, because we don't care about New Orleans basketball.
You ever have it with your credit card where you see like a little $2 or $3 charge that you don't recognize and you think to yourself, huh, It's funny. I don't remember that. But you really don't think a whole lot of it. Maybe it's some pending charge from something you don't recognize, business with a different name. But then it turns out later that that was someone who had gotten a hold of your credit card and was just kind of testing out to see if you would notice before they really go in for it. You can think of this situation that way. Those are the easy ones to get to, right? It's easy to get to players at programs that don't have big NIL budgets, at places where they're not getting paid money to where they would say, yeah, I'm not going to risk my bag over the little bit that you're offering me. But if it works at one place, couldn't they try to move it up the line and do it at slightly bigger and slightly bigger places? That's why I think people might care. At least they should.
Next question.
Shedeur Sanders has an oblique injury. He was hurt during a joint practice with the Eagles. He's day-to-day for the Cleveland Browns. So the Eagles, Kenny Pickett has somewhat of a significant hamstring injury. Dylan Gabriel has missed time with hamstring tightness. Shedeur Sanders, he actually had missed one practice with a sore shoulder, but now has an oblique injury. The only guy that's been healthy is the oldest one there. Joe Flacco is just like, yeah, I'll be 40 years old and healthier than all of these guys in their 20s. It's a mess that they have four quarterbacks as is, and none of them are probably any good. It's an even bigger mess because they all keep getting hurt in training camp, and they're having to bring in Tyler Huntley to maybe be the backup to Joe Flacco just because he's not hurt.
Also, all three of those are soft tissue injuries as opposed to, you know, a guy breaking a bone or something along those lines. That should be concerning if you're a fan of the Browns. Why are all of our young players at quarterback, why are they all dealing with injuries that you probably should be avoiding based on how you train and the old guy isn't?
Well, okay, should we give Pete Carroll credit? Because the Raiders, I mean, they don't have any injuries. Even the Christian Wilkins thing happened before Carroll got here, and then it wasn't, he didn't exacerbate it because training camp was too physical or hard or something. Like, that situation aside, but like, maybe we give Pete Carroll credit because the Raiders aren't dying in practice like other teams are?
Well, I think you have to start from the top and say, who's healthier than Pete Carroll?
Have the healthiest coach in the league at 73, and your team will be in good shape. Nobody will get hurt.
Great question. Thank you.
The New York Mets lead the Cincinnati Reds by a half game in the NL wildcard race. That is for the last spot in the NL playoff picture. The Mets, after losing yesterday, have lost 13 of their last 15 games. They're not going to miss the playoffs because the Reds catch them, are they?
Wouldn't it be funny if it did happen, though?
It would be.
Wouldn't it be awesome? It would be so cool. And as a Yankees fan, I'm happy to say, no, look over in Queens. Things are way worse over there. Don't worry about the fact that the Yankees are also getting chased down for the final wild card spot.
Both the Yankees and Mets are a half game ahead for the last wild card spot of a team in Ohio. That's the current state of New York baseball. It's great. Let's go Guardians. Let's go Reds. Let's make things funny in the playoffs.
That's a great, great question.
The Yankees are selling plush toys of Aaron Judge's dog, Gus and Penny. Adam, do you want these for Christmas?
I don't need any more stuff in my house, but will I be sending Gus and Penny to people? Possibly.
Were you aware of Gus and Penny before this? Like, are they popular enough amongst Yankees fans that this is actually something they should be selling?
Oh, yeah, because if you follow any of the social media around the Yankees, you've seen that Aaron Judge has brought the dogs to the game pregame and let them run around on the field. So they're the softer side of our giant captain.
Okay, I'm fishing a little bit here with you because in the past you've said big tennis guy. I don't know who it was. I saw the video earlier this week of a player's dog, I think it was a dachshund, ran out onto the court after the match. I can't remember who it was. Big fan of that. Have somebody bring your dog to your match, and then if you win, they get to come out on the court and celebrate with you. I'm all on board.
Well, I'll tell you that there are times that I've tried to take my somewhat antisocial dog to the dog park because you know, he's an Australian Shepherd. He needs to run around and get his crazy energy out. But there have been too many dogs, or like dogs he doesn't like there. And we've run right next door to the tennis courts when no one's there. I just throw the ball around the tennis court and let him sprint around there. So I think it's absolutely great that dogs and tennis courts are mixing.
Your dog does not like dog parks because he doesn't get along with other dogs, or other dogs are too aggressive. What does he not like about the other dogs?
So the problem is he wasn't particularly well socialized as a puppy. I didn't have him as a puppy, but he wasn't particularly well socialized at the time. And so he goes to the dog park and he doesn't really understand how to play with the other dogs. And then he gets frustrated. And the way he gets frustrated is either to run up and bark at them. He's not going to hurt them. He just runs up and barks at them. Or in a less couth way, he might just start humping them if he doesn't get what he wants from them.
Does he like to be chased?
Oh, if the other dogs would just chase him all day, he'd be thrilled. Or if he could just chase them all day, he'd be thrilled. But the problem is then they want to, you know, they want to wrestle, or they want to figure out how to share a ball or something like that. And he just kind of, you know, derps around like he's been in solitary confinement.
Okay. We might have to set this up, because the only thing Churro wants to do with other dogs is chase them. He does not want to do anything else. And when the other dog gets tired of being chased, he will just stand and stare at them and bark at them, and then we'll try to, depending on how tall the dog is, just try to like bite at their ankles or their ears, just as a like, hey, run from me. I want to chase you.
Oh, it sounds like they have similarly stupid play styles.
Yes. One issue though, he's a bulldog. You're getting 4 minutes of this. It's not going to be enough to actually get some energy out of your dog. I apologize for that in advance.
Yeah, that's fine, because my dog will probably annoy yours within 4 minutes anyway, and to be like, will you please get this idiot out of here?
Next question.
Roger Goodell says he won't get involved with ESPN's journalism. ESPN recently purchased the NFL Network and Red Zone from the NFL, but as a part of that deal, the NFL now owns 10% of ESPN. ESPN had a town hall, and on a recorded message, Roger Goodell said he would not influence any of the reporting by ESPN employees. I'm going to go out on a limb and guess that you're in the same boat as me, saying that I don't believe that.
I believe I sent you a Josh Hermsmeyer tweet that said that's garbage, because they were already influencing content long before they had an actual ownership stake, just when they had a massive rights deal with ESPN, the NFL. So I'll go ahead and say Raj might just find a way.
Next question.
The NFL will have a disciplinary hearing for Rashee Rice on September 30th. Rice pleaded guilty to 2 third-degree felony charges. If you remember, he was in an accident while he was racing on the highway and then ran away from the scene. So he has pleaded guilty to this. The hearing is not going to be until after the Chiefs play 4 games this season. I saw an update yesterday that the judge that the NFLPA and the NFL use to sort of figure out these scenarios when they can't have some sort of agreement between each other, this is just what fits into her schedule, and that's basically the reasoning as to why it's happening on September 30th, as opposed to, you know, now or before the season starts. So we could have a scenario where Rashee Rice plays the first 4 games of the year for the Chiefs and then gets suspended for the second 4 games of the Chiefs schedule.
So you know how at Las Vegas Motor Speedway, they I don't know if they still have it, but they used to have a program where kids could come out and street race their cars, but like in a controlled setting.
I was not aware of this at all, but please go ahead.
Yeah. I think that the smart professional leagues should figure out a way to do this for their athletes. They should set up a situation where it's like, hey, instead of, say, going 150 miles an hour up and down a residential street in Las Vegas and killing a woman and her dog, maybe you should do this in a more controlled environment where you can still take your car out, see how damn fast it can go, but maybe not at the risk of killing people.
can also include the Georgia Bulldogs and their football
team. That's what I'm saying.
We need to start that in college in a certain city. That'd be pretty helpful. All right, coming up next here on ESPN Las Vegas, we're going to get into the Las Vegas Aces. Another big game for the Aces that they are moving up the WNBA standings. Can they take down the Phoenix Mercury tomorrow? The Aces play the Phoenix Mercury tomorrow. That game is in Phoenix. The Aces are just one game behind Phoenix. They have the same number of wins. Aces have two more losses at the moment. So not an even number of games played, but just one game back of Phoenix in the WNBA standings. The Aces have gone from fighting for that final eighth spot in the playoffs to now having a real chance at getting a top four seed and home court advantage in the first round of the playoffs. But Adam, yesterday we talked a little bit about the Aces game against New York and the Aces defense looking better recently. And I went through because they've won 10 of 13. They've won five in a row as well. And if you look at their defensive numbers throughout the season, their full season defensive rating is 103.8. That's ninth best in the league. They've been a bad defensive team. During the 10 and 3 run, they're 107.2. Their defense has been worse. That's 11th best. Now, there's two games where they lost to Minnesota and like didn't get a stop on any possession the entire game that plays in there. But even during their stretch of five straight wins, their defensive rating is 102.8, which is 1 point better than what they are for the full season. But that's not a huge jump. It is fifth best in the league over that time period. What I thought was interesting, the offense is where they've had this huge improvement for the full season. They have the seventh best offense in the league. It's 103.1 points per 100 possessions. During the run where they've won 10 of 13, that offensive rating is 108.8. And during this 5-0 stretch, they actually have the best offense in the WNBA, scoring 115.2 points per 100 possession. Jewel Lloyd's coming off the bench, and the Aces have the best offense in the WNBA. What a fix by Becky Hammon.
What a fix by Jewel Lloyd. Who's the one who went and said, let's bring me off the bench and give that a shot. I'm curious also, you might not have this at your fingertips right now, but I'm curious if the Aces are at all lengthening out possessions at either end of the floor, and maybe that's contributing to better defense without better defensive rating, right? If teams aren't scoring as quickly or as much in transition against them, that can be something that affects overall scoring without changing your defensive rating, but sometimes you just want to make the other team work a little harder for the points than they have been. So, you know, for the Aces, I think you probably can look at both of those things. I would guess, I would make an educated guess that they're at least making other teams work a little harder to score.
So their pace is pretty similar overall. Now that obviously factors in offense and defensive possessions. I don't have the individual between the offense and defense. This is what I found most interesting, just trying to look through the last five and the last 13 compared to the full season. The Aces' field goal percentage and three-point percentage, basically identical. They are not like making a higher percentage of shots as a team in these last 13 or in these last five compared to the rest of the season. They have not suddenly become a better shooting team. Jewel Lloyd has. Her shooting numbers are up, especially from three since she's been coming off the bench. But team-wide, it's not any, they're almost the same. What has jumped the most? The Aces' first 20 games of the season, they were 11th in offensive rebounding rate. They were bottom three in the WNBA at getting their own misses. In the last 13, that 10-3 stretch, they're number one in offensive rebounding rate. They went from bad, not getting any of their own misses, to the best in the WNBA over a 13-game stretch here. They're also first now in free throw attempts and fouls drawn. They were top half in those stats. They were not close to the bottom. They were top half in both of those stats, but they're now number one over the last 13 games at getting to the line and getting other teams in foul while also grabbing a bunch of offensive rebounds. So I guess the break it down way, the finesse hasn't gotten better. They're not exactly showing us that they're more skilled than they were before. They just might be beating teams up on offense, and that's how they've been a much more efficient team on the season, or on this second half of the season, because they're just getting inside, getting offensive rebounds, and getting fouled at a higher rate than anybody else in the league.
And the other piece of this equation, as I know we're going to talk to Callie about here in a minute, is they got very fortunate with New York in particular, where you got them off a back-to-back and without Breonna Stewart. And I think what you're seeing with this Aces team, that's not to say that they don't get credit for the win, is that there's just not a lot of margin to be wrong, right? The championship Aces teams had enough talent that you could not get everything right and still win games. And I don't think this group has that sort of luxury. We saw it with Jewel Lloyd's inefficiency in the starting lineup and inability to get her own shot, inability to just get shots, period. That was something that was holding them back in a way that they absolutely could not overcome. And the other piece of this equation, Tyler, is if we talk about free throws and we talk about the ability to get your own rebound and make shots, you're talking about situations where the other team can't run. And I know you're saying pace number obviously combines offense, defense, but in simple basketball logic, if you're going to force the other team to take the ball out under the basket, they are not going to be able to get as many easy points on you.
Yeah. The defensively for the Aces, I think the two biggest problems from watching them has been the amount of times that teams get out and run against them. I should say their turnovers are also down a little bit, not as drastic as some of these other numbers. So they're not giving away the sort of free run out plays as much as they had been as well. But the two biggest problems, transitionally, they were giving up a lot of sort of free layups to teams. And then I think in the half court, their ball screen defense has been pretty bad this year. Largely the guards just get stuck on every screen that ever gets set. If the half court defense maybe hasn't improved that much, you're right, giving up fewer of the transition opportunities. And here's the other part. Just making teams pay more attention to, oh, the Aces are doing what on the offensive glass now, means they might keep more bodies in and less players would leak out or even think about getting out as quickly. Even if you don't get the offensive rebound, it's something that can make a difference in the way a team actually plays against you on that end of the floor that prevents some of those runouts. So it's 13 games, which normally isn't a big sample, but is a fourth of a WNBA season, so it kind of is a big sample in this league. I'll be curious to see what it looks like the rest of the season. Are they just a great offensive rebounding team now? Is that something that they just are now, that they were able to change that midseason? Or is this just a weird 13-game stretch where, like you said, maybe they've gotten fortunate with teams they've played or matchups they've had or players that have not played in games that has helped lead to that. But the Aces certainly have gotten much, much better offensively in this run here. And defensively, there's a little bit of improvement, but not a ton that you would look at and say, hey, they could actually win a WNBA title this season. Coming up next, we're going to stick here with the Aces, with the WNBA, as Callie Fenn joins the show from the Review Journal. Joining us now from the Review Journal, it's Callie Fenn. Good morning, Callie. Thanks for coming on with us.
Good morning. You got it.
So the first thing I want to ask, because we were just talking about the Aces, and if you look at their offensive rating throughout the season, it hasn't been good, but during their 5-game winning streak, they've got the best offense in the league, and during their 10 wins in 13 games, they're the third best offense in the league. And the biggest number that jumped out is that their offensive rebounding numbers, they're number one in offensive rebounding rate over the last 13 games, but it was 11th before that. Have you noticed, is that like a coaching concerted effort to say, hey, let's get on the offensive glass and rebound that way? Or is that just kind of happened over these last 13 games?
No, I mean, that's an intentional thing. And it's so funny that you mentioned it, because I asked Becky Hammon about it, because it stood out to me as well, especially just from someone like Asia Wilson, who we obviously know is like a dominant big on the court. But she's not even been like a consistent rebounder. Like sometimes she and Becky Hammon will joke that Asia would like forget to rebound if nobody ever told her to. And so like there are some games where you can kind of like see that. But Becky said that like this season, at this point in the season specifically, she's realized that like the team just needs to prioritize offensive rebounding. In the past, she prioritized transition defense. So some of her players, like in Asia Wilson, didn't even have a green light for offensive rebounding. But Becky said that she started doing some analytics. She started setting like some NBA teams. And she said, screw the transition defense. Let's get more possessions. So offensive rebounding has been a huge point of emphasis for the entire team. And it's like finally starting to click, I think, now. And you can actually see the results. But that wasn't something that they really even prioritized last season at all.
It feels like that might be... Oh, sorry about that. It feels like that might be Becky Hammond with a really wise coaching move for a team that has just consistently struggled to get any flow going on offense. Now, that's changed a little bit with Jewel Lloyd's move to the bench and this emphasis on offensive rebounding. But how much do you think can be attributed to each of those things? Because the move to Jewel Lloyd to the bench kind of coincided with this run as well.
Yeah, I mean, I think not only just like moving Jewel Lloyd to the bench, but then also Melissa Smith, the forward that they traded for at the end of June, also kind of like getting acclimated in the starting lineup. Like, I think a lot of things have had to like come together for this Aces like upswing. I do think that Jewel, it's been huge. I mean, they're 7-1 with her coming off the bench. She's had three 20-plus point performances since then. And before that move to the bench, she was averaging like a near career low 10 points per game. Now she's up to like almost 16 points per game. So this is notable. And what's so funny, I think, about it is that she's still playing starter minutes. She's still playing a significant amount of time with that opening rotation, like with those players who are in the opening rotation, I should say. It's just like, it seems like almost like a mental switch when you watch the games. And I think, you know, she is somebody that needs to get into a rhythm. She's more like a rhythm shooter, and she can kind of do that in the minutes that she does get with that second group. So it does matter. I think Jewel, it's huge to have her coming off the bench and able to score like 21 points, 27 points, like she did against the Liberty. But then also I really like Melissa Smith in the starting lineup, like alongside Asia. She just brings some size. She's able to space the floor and all these different things. She's also a really strong rebounder, but more of a scoring threat than Kia Stokes was in the starting lineup. So it's a lot of things have changed for the Aces, and you kind of pointed them all out.
I'm curious if it was necessary for a team that underperformed last year and then was fighting for a playoff spot, but they lost to Minnesota by over 50 points. Like, was that a wake-up call, and, like, should they have had one maybe earlier in the year? But, like, is that a true turning point in the season that they got beat down so bad that it's led to some significantly better play?
I mean, I think that was a historically bad loss, like, in the sense that, like, no WNBA lost that bad, like, since 1998 or something wild like that. So, yeah, I mean, you would hope that it wouldn't come down to that. But, of course, you're right. You know, they haven't lost since that embarrassing showing. And it makes sense, you know. Afterward, Asia Wilson, she was pretty candid about, you know, some of the conversations she had with the team. I don't know if it was like a group chat or if she sent out like, you know, individual messages to everybody, but she said that she sent out a clear, you know, warning, like, this can never happen again. And if you think that this was okay, then like, we don't need you in the gym. I thought that was a really strong wording, like, we don't need you in the gym. That's harsh, but it's so true. You know, like, if you're okay with losing by 53 points on your own home court, then yeah, maybe you probably shouldn't be on the Aces. So I thought it was really interesting that she said that, and a lot of the players said that it really resonated with them. So I think, you know, turning point in the season for sure, but it's like, it's wild because if you look through kind of their season to this point, they've had a few games like that, yeah. Like, where maybe not 53-point blowouts, but they've had, like, some really rough losses that maybe you didn't expect them to give up, and then they come back and they go on, like, a little two-game, three-game win streak. So it's cool to see that this is more of a sustained success. And to me, it looks less like a knee-jerk reaction to that loss against Minnesota and more just like, okay, things are finally starting to click into place.
Callie, I'm curious for your perspective from seeing Becky Hammond and Asia Wilson over a number of years. You talk about the idea of a wake-up call, and Becky Hammond's been the coach of the Aces for a number of years, and we all know that after a while, players can not tune out certain voices, but maybe it doesn't have the same effect. And then you mentioned that Asia Wilson was the one to step up and say, hey, no, we can't be doing this anymore. As Asia Wilson has kind of grown up, you know, as the face of the league, the face of this team, have you noticed more of that in particular this year, of her kind of being the one to try to motivate this team as much as Becky Hammond?
I see. I mean, 100%. And I would even say maybe, I don't want to say more than Becky Hammon, but like that's almost like what I'm tempted to say, because Asia has like really stepped up. And I think in ways that Becky Hammon has like empowered her too. Like, I think Becky's wanting to take a step back. Like, for example, we just talked about that loss to the Minnesota Lynx, where they got blown out by 53 points afterward. Becky Hammon mentioned, she was like, you know what, I pulled some statistics from that game and I'm going to show them to these players, like I'm going to talk to them about it. And then immediately after like their first game following that loss, I asked her like, hey, like, did you talk to the players about those statistics that you pulled? And she was like, actually, no, you know what, I looked at them and I asked if I needed to say anything. And they said no, because Asia had already talked to them. So like, oh, Becky, wow, didn't have to say a single word to them. And then there's also the fact that Becky is like requiring all of the players now to become a lot more involved in the defensive scout. And Asia has spoken about how like she's really taken point with that. And a lot of the players like Jewel Lloyd and Jackie Young have talked about how like having Asia in the locker room with a laptop going over film and then reviewing it with players and like, you know, sitting at a whiteboard and like talking through details has really changed things. That's like a new thing, and maybe in the past like 2-3 weeks or so. But like, that's, I mean, that's to have Asia like leading that, you know, I wrote about it. Asia mentioned that like it's changed the way that she views the game. It's changed her as a leader. So these are like new tangible things that where you can see like, okay, Asia's making a concerted effort to like lead this team differently. And Becky's almost like putting it in her hands. So it's really interesting to see. I don't think it's like, you know, Becky is like giving up or by any means or anything, but I think she just sees maybe the power of having the player say and do certain things versus maybe hearing it from a coach.
Looking beyond this year, there's got to be a CBA agreed to, so maybe we don't even have a next season, but everybody's a free agent. Like, this entire Aces roster, the entire WNBA, everybody's a free agent. What happens in the offseason for the Aces? Like, what does this roster look like, assuming we get a CBA agreed to, and you can kind of remake the entire thing if you want to?
Yeah, and you know what? That's kind of a scary question. And I think about it like every other day this season, because I'm like, wow, this is going to be a completely different team. And you're right, the CBA is a huge part of that. They have until mid-October to get that done. Otherwise, we're looking at something weird, maybe work stoppage or something like that, which would be interesting, but obviously we'd all hope to avoid. So hopefully they can agree to that. But even if they do, the reality is that so many players, you know, were really mindful about their contracts and did not extend past this season. So you look at the roster, the Aces roster specifically, everybody and their mom is a free agent after this season, except for players that were drafted like this season or last season. So it's going to be really interesting. It's like, how do you keep as many players, like how do you keep the core together? Because really that's, you know, Asia Wilson, Jackie Young, Chelsea Gray, like that's the core. Of course, like Jewel has come in, but like she was like a 1-year rental. Like that's really what that contract breaks down to. And then there's the other difficult part, which is expansion drafts are going to play a big role. That was an issue this past offseason. That's how they lost Kate Martin, which, I mean, maybe like in the grand scheme, not a huge loss, but still like it mattered for the team. And so like we have a bunch of expansion teams coming in. So like it's you're going to lose a few more players. And so it's going to be a lot, like free agency and just, you know, how they choose to architect this team. Obviously Asia Wilson has got to be your priority. She's going to be the one they give the core designation to. It's almost like the NFL franchise tag. Like you can bet money on that. But everything else is just like a huge question mark. And I think that that's going to be really interesting.
So as we look now to the rest of this season and we see the run that the Aces have gone on, has it changed your opinion about what the ceiling of this team is in the 2025 season?
Has it changed my mind about the ceiling for this team? I mean, I think that they opened this season and they were really, really open and vocal about their championship goals. And I think it was a little bit difficult for me to imagine that, even with, you know, the changes that they've made, adding Jewel and things like that. It seemed to me like losing Kelsey would impact some things. Just, I mean, there's, we could go, that's a maybe different conversation, but it just, I didn't know about championship, especially just with the way that their season ended last year. So like they got knocked out of the finals, I mean the semifinals, by the New York Liberty. And for me, that's still the question. It's like, can you compete with the New York Liberty and Minnesota Lynxes? And I know they just beat the Liberty, but the Liberty were down some key players like Brianna Stewart. And not to make excuses, obviously it still matters. Like in the standings, it's an important win for the Aces. But like for me to kind of like change my view on who's feeling for this team, it would be really encouraging to see them compete with like a fully healthy Liberty, a fully healthy Minnesota Lynx, because that's what's going to matter. Like if you look at their playoff picture, let's say, I mean, it wouldn't be the worst thing if they stay at the spot that they're in and they have the number five spot going into the playoffs, because maybe their semifinal situation ends up a little bit different. They don't have to face somebody like New York like they did last year. But either way, it's like you're going to have to face the big dogs eventually, and you kind of have to show that you're able to do that. And I don't know if we've really seen that yet. So for me, you know, my views on the ceiling, I don't know if they've changed. I'm not sure yet.
Callie, before we let you go, same thing I'm always going to ask you, and I'm assuming the answer is still no. Nothing new about the LVCVA investigation by the WNBA?
No. Okay. You know, I follow up about this like once a week, and I'm often referred to Kathy Engelbert, the commissioner's previous comments at the WNBA draft, which was in April, which was forever ago, where she said that they are requesting documents. And that the process is still underway. I mean, I will say I've also requested the documents, like contracts and things like that, and I've not gotten them either. So that's, I don't know. The LVCVA has said that they've been like fully cooperative with the investigation, but it seems that maybe the LVCVA is just like over the whole thing, and they realize like they can't be forced. Like they don't work for the WNBA. You know what I mean? So it seems like things are at a really big standstill. And it'll be interesting to me to see, like, when that gets resolved. Because as I said in the past, I feel like this is just a really bad look for the league. Like, you can't a nearly two-year-long investigation. I feel like that's kind of embarrassing.
Well, she is Callie Finn from the Review Journal. Callie, thank you so much for joining us. We appreciate it.
Thanks for having me.
So there is Callie Finn on the Aces and the WNBA and the never-ending, did the Aces circumvent the salary cap with the LVC investigation that apparently has just come to a complete standstill. All right, we've got tickets to give away to go see the Aces. It's the Aces and the Atlanta Dream on Tuesday at Michelob Ultra Arena. Thanks to Westar Credit Union and Richard Harris Law. 702-364-1100. That is the phone number if you want to win. Two tickets in the ESPN Fan Zone to Aces and Dream on Tuesday. Call in now at 702-364-1100. That's 702-364-1100. We'll take caller number. Adam Candy is in today for Ed Graney. Adam, would you say that I always give the listeners what they want?
Not even close, but that's okay.
Okay, good. I need to make sure I start doing that because, and you're going to love this, Franz on the text line texted in, Tyler, what are some of your predictions for the upcoming Premier League season? Top four, relegation candidates, first manager sack, top goal scorer, thoughts? Thanks, guys. Happy Friday. So I think I have to give Franz what he wants, Adam.
Okay, so slow down. First of all, I need you to show me that Franz did not text from your phone. And also, Franz, if you're listening and you are a real person, we don't like you.
I like you, Franz.
I don't like you at all.
I'm a big fan of Franz right now. I can tell you, Franz.
Give Franz what he wants, Tyler.
Franz has a Las Vegas area code, Las Vegas phone number here. My phone is not. I got a Mississippi area code, so it's not my phone. I'm telling you, it's not mine. I don't know Franz. Franz Ferguson, by the way, is the last name. I don't know if that makes you think he's more or less real if I tell you the last name there, too. But I'll start here. The top four. Arsenal is going to win the league. Obviously, they're the greatest team in the world. I think Man City is going to be really good. They're going to have Rodri back. He tore his ACL last year, and he is their most important player. And then I think Liverpool's third. And I don't think Chelsea finishes top four. I'm going to take Aston Villa instead. Chelsea just won the Club World Cup, but nobody cares about that. It's not a real tournament. First manager to be sacked, Eddie Howe at Newcastle. I don't think Newcastle is going to be that good this season. Not like they're going to get relegated, but they think they should be in the top four as well. But they start with Aston Villa, Liverpool, they get Leeds, who's going to be bad, then Wolves, Bournemouth, Arsenal, and Nottingham Forest. There are a lot of games that they probably lose to good teams, but also a Bournemouth game, a Wolves game, a Nottingham Forest game, that they lose a couple of those, they could have a really bad first six, seven, eight games of the season, and if they're expecting to actually finish in the top four, be legitimate contenders, they could decide to fire their manager first. Top goal scorer, Erling Haaland, that one, I think, is what's going to happen there. And as far as the relegation teams, it's gotten too easy to where it's just the three teams that come up are the three teams that get relegated the very next year. So I'll just hope that Tottenham gets relegated. They were close-ish last year, but I hope it's Tottenham this season. Adam, I do want to ask you something. Do you think you can guess the quickest firing of a manager in the history of the Premier League? Talking start of the season, not somebody that got hired in season, but start of the season, what is the quickest that a manager has been fired in the Premier League?
And it's not like a Carlos Beltran situation where you get the job before the season, you never get to coach again.
Yes, all of these managers on this list actually did coach or manage a game.
I'm going to say after three games.
Okay, all right, so the way this is listed off, Opta had a good story on this. The way this is listed off, it's two games, but they listed it off by days. Paul Sturrock got fired in 2004 after 9 days into the season and two games by Southampton.
That is amazing, impressive. I have a question for you that is related. At what age did you become a soccer fan?
High school, so I don't know, 16 maybe, something like that.
And how long did it take you to actually learn things about all of these teams? Because one of the things that slows me down in terms of the Premier League is it's just so much to get a handle on.
Okay, how much do I know about Burnley? Nothing. Not at all. How much do I know about Sunderland? Not much at all. The bottom three teams that come up, and then like a few other teams, don't pay a whole lot of attention to. But it took a few years. The real key, Adam, was when NBC Sports Network at the time, when they started broadcasting basically every game, where you could watch every game. That's when it really became, oh, I can watch this every weekend when I wake up in the morning, and I can watch other teams. That's when it really took off to knowing and caring about soccer in England.